Las Vegas, Nevada, a city accustomed to high stakes. But tonight, the highest stakes of all.
Leadership of the free world. It's Tuesday Night Debates.
Will it be a Hillary Hail Mary, or is it time to burn, baby, burn?
Will Jim Webb take another life?
And what about the block of granite?
There's also another guy named something like Mayor McCheese.
At the end of the night, one debater will get a rose from Anderson Cooper.
I don't think that's exactly how it works.
We'll find out in minutes when these five debaters kick off.
It's no secret, these people don't like each other.
How big is this debate? Big.
It is so big.
We cannot communicate how big it is.
Now let's throw it down to our sideline reporter, Colin McEnroe, with lots of girl questions and whether people have any boo-boos.
Yes, well, in fact, Bernie Sanders, I talked to Bernie Sanders' people. Obviously, he's got some arthritis in his hip and in one of his knees. That continues to bother him. He doesn't think it's going to limit his play tonight. Hillary Clinton, of course, has been through the usual concussion protocol. And I didn't bother to talk to the other three guys because they have no chance. But that's – I'm actually not a sideline reporter. Although I'd actually kind of like to be a sideline. I could be Pam Oliver. All right. So today on The Nose, we are going to talk about what kind of television was that debate on Tuesday night. Did CNN own too much of our political process? Did they make Jim Webb look too weird, or was it his job not to look so weird? We're also going to talk about a renewal in the debate about tipping. This is kind of – just bubbles up from time to time. We've actually done one Colin McEnroe show and one episode of Where We Live, both about tipping. But now, because of Danny Meyer's declaration that his restaurants will not have tipping anymore, the conversation renews itself. And then lastly, the very sad arc of Lamar Odom. He rose from the streets to basketball – Lamar Odom. He rose from the streets to basketball stardom and then went on to reality TV stardom. And now it seems as though his origins are dragging him back down. Or maybe that's not exactly how the story goes. We'll talk about that as we go along. Who will we talk about that with on this day of excitement in the world of tipping? Well, Jim Chapdelaine smashes his Stratocaster if his tip is less than 25%. Kate Rushen is a poet. Don't forget to tip your poet at katerushenpoet.com. And Teresa Kramer is founder of The Cut, a publication for Connecticut young adults who leave 12% because they're so grumpy. So
and poor.
So
don't forget poor.
Poor and grumpy and poor and grumpy. All right. We're going to begin with a debate on CNN. It was staged live from a Las Vegas casino owned by Steve Wynn, who doesn't give the Democratic Party any money, gives lots to the Republican Party. Pop star Sheryl Crow sang the national anthem. Jim Chapdelaine, probably the less that we say about that, the better. I just said that to the musician. It didn't go well.
No. You know what?
Sheryl Crow? Who could be less relevant than Sheryl Crow at this point?
Lincoln Chafee, actually. Yeah, okay. That's the question. I don't. If you're going to just throw these softballs up here, I'm going to hit them.
You guys, that was so scripted. I know. I saw you meeting
but
in the corner.
I do want to talk a little bit about the way in which in these situations something that is part of American polity, the process by which we choose our most important office, gets turned into a TV program and kind of owned by a TV network for a while so that they get to make all kinds of fairly arbitrary decisions about it and how it's going to go, starting with the fact, Teresa Kramer, that it's only going to be on cable television, which is a problem for cord-cutting, grumpy, young Connecticut adults such as yourself.
It is a problem. They allege that you can stream these things on the internet, and I tried this with one of the Republican debates, and it just didn't go very well, and I couldn't tell if the internet just hated me or if it was because they will ask you to authenticate that you have cable, and I am capable of lying to these things and just using someone else's information, but it still wouldn't let me watch it. And so I just didn't even try when it came to this debate.
You didn't want to try to get virtual reality goggles and do that thing? You could have. They did do that, right?
That would have induced a panic attack if I thought I was actually there. I did not watch it. All of my exposure has been post-debate, which is totally fine at this point because you can just go back and watch all the pertinent clips that everyone else thought was interesting and skip over all the stuff that didn't matter.
But Jim Chapdelaine, this is one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is – from that opening roll, I mean, you know, we made a little joke about it with the Monday Night Football stuff, but that's how they rolled in with – it really looked like they were introducing a football game or something like that. And from there all the way along, so much of this was about CNN and how CNN wanted to do this and their alleged – incredibly weak partnership with Facebook and all this stuff. And you start – I don't know. It's a TV program more than it's part of our political process, although it's a deathly important part of our political process. I mean, maybe there's nothing you can do about that.
Well, it's the commercialization of something that should be available to everybody. And at one point I thought somebody was going to yell, "I'm Spartacus," because it's totally network owned. And the fact that it's not accessible to everybody is absurd. And we all should be seeing it. The other thing that was bugging me was Anderson Cooper's new assertive personality. Like, I'm going to show you people who's the real boss here. I thought he was running for a while.
I don't know.
I couldn't quite tell.
I kind of appreciated a little bit anyway of the fact that he did in fact confront them from time to time, and if they evaded something, he would say that's not the question.
I don't mind that. I just felt like he was like that guy in the Hunger Games with the button that it push and then you disappear into somewhere.
He's a little bit front and center, and pretty much the star of it, as opposed to I think maybe
which is he should be sort of invisible and just be the steadying hand.
Jim Lehrer, a guy you didn't notice so much.
Right.
You
know? Right.
So. Kate, not to make you responsible for all diversity and lack thereof, but, you know, watching this debate, I mean, here we are, the Democratic Party supposedly, and I think one of the panelists even said this, one of the candidates even said this, you know, 50% not white people, you know. And so here you have, first of all, this all-white panel of five candidates. Then you've got Anderson Cooper, like maybe the whitest guy in America. And then you've got a few other sort of subsidiary people who are responsible for asking the questions about diversity, except that it's even worse than that because Don Lemon, who's really the black journalist, doesn't even get to ask a black journalist question. He gets to introduce a really weak black Facebook clip from who knows who. And somehow or other, this didn't seem to me to be structured in any way like what we think the strength of the Democratic Party is, that it has triumphed in the climate of modern demographics. You know, that starting in 2008, you just couldn't run exclusively white and win. And they get that in the way that the Republicans have not gotten it. But there's something wrong with this, just the coloration of this debate.
Well, you said it, Colin. I'm glad you did. Just looking at the optics, I was disappointed. I felt that even though it was a big show, I found myself asking, well, where's the juice? I felt that the field didn't look robust. And it had me wondering where some of the people like Ann Richards were or Barbara Lee, the rep from California. And I don't know who made the decision that people would ask questions based on their self-identity. I thought it was ridiculous, or other people's perception of who they were. I thought it was ridiculous. So I saw the debate as a Democratic debate versus the Republican debate, and I didn't think the Democrats looked good. I thought they looked pale and pallid, and I wondered what...
And pasty. Let's go pasty.
Bad lighting.
All the peas.
Bad lighting.
Sorry about that. But I did wonder, when I looked at some of the candidates and listened to them, what base they were supposed to be energizing.
That's, you know, what you just said, I haven't heard anybody say that, but it is – there are all kinds of contests going on in any given moment. And one of them was this debate against the other debates, right? That was one of the football games being played was the Democratic debate versus the Republican debate. And, you know, so then the truism was, well, at least this was a debate about substance and there were issues being discussed and policies being discussed and people were not insulting one another and talking about whether they were bad-looking women or not, or, you know, and nobody was saying horrible things about Mexicans. And I guess I'm really saying Donald Trump was not at this debate. But anyway, there were substantial differences. But I also feel as though – and so I don't know how much of this has penetrated into the world of you cable cutters, Teresa Kramer, that – you know, CNN, they made all kinds of decisions about how they were going to structure this, and there was this weird rule. It seemed like a party game or something, like if I say your name, then you get to talk. But if I don't say your name, you can't talk. But, I mean, it seemed – if you cut through that, it seemed as though they really only wanted to have Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. They were trying to find some way to turn these other three guys into department store mannequins. Not that that was going to be very hard to do given their overall level of preparation for the debate itself. But, you know, I do feel as though television – sometimes the only thing television measures It's like, you know, the SAT test only really measures how well you do on the SAT test, how good you are at taking that test. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really correspond to anything else. Sometimes I feel television only really measures how good you are at being on television. And I think Jim Webb was a real victim of that.
I'm not sure what the question
maybe
is.
Maybe I can jump. Maybe I can jump in.
Yeah.
I can jump in.
You have a thought about it. Yeah.
You know, who was advising Jim Webb? Who dressed him? I was so distracted by his collar.
I kept
wondering why his collar was so tight.
It was
tight.
Because it was pinned. I think it was because he actually buttoned the little things on the end of the collar, which so it made everything look like he was wearing a neck pillow or something.
Yeah, so I Googled him to see who he was. I said, oh, this guy is running the Navy? Really?
Well, he's actually a pretty substantial guy, although I have to say Larry Wilmore did superimpose a middle toe on Jim Webb's head. And you could not tell the difference. And I think they really did try to marginalize Jim Webb, who's not very nimble in front of the microphone. Or not very nimble. He's certainly not photogenic. He seemed like this anger. I'm going to get my time in. And then he blew all his time talking about how he's going to get his time.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem very presidential.
No. I do want to say, I mean, so here's who Jim Webb actually is. And I also, first of all, want to confess, I'm as bad as anybody else. At a certain point, I was live tweeting the debate. At a certain point, because he was just obsessively complaining about how much time he wasn't getting, and every time they would come back to him, he'd get very crabby about this, I tweeted, Jim Webb is basically the guy at Red Lobster whose order hasn't been taken yet. And then it got vastly retweeted in favor. And I was very proud of my little self for doing this. But then, you know, you really sort of think about who this guy is. So he's been a U.S. senator. He's been Secretary of the Navy. He's held lots of other impressive posts. He was this incredibly decorated serviceman. And, you know, we're going to be talking about this whole thing where he talked about killing somebody. But the incident, I mean, really was an incident of incredible valor and heroism, the way that it has been described. He's also the author of 10 books, including several, I think, 8 novels, some of them really critically acclaimed. And then this much talked about nonfiction book that was, I think, was called Born Fighting. It's the history of the Scotch Irish in America. My favorite, he's taught at the Harvard Institute of Politics and the U.S. Naval Academy, where he's taught literature at the U.S. Naval Academy. My favorite thing about him, I'd forgotten about it until I sort of went back and read about him, was in 2006, when this country was really convulsed about our involvement in Iraq, he was at a reception for newly elected members of Congress. And then President Bush, he wouldn't get in line to have his picture taken with Bush. He was so appalled by Bush's policies in Iraq. So the president approached him later after this line for picture taking and said, how's your boy, referring to Webb's son, who was a Marine serving in Iraq. And Webb said, I'd like to get them out of Iraq, Mr. President. And Bush says again, that's not what I asked you. How's your boy? And Webb responded, that's between me and my boy, Mr. President. It was sort of leaked that he said to his friends afterwards that he really wanted to slug Bush, as he put it.
I've seen some of that during the debate.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, part of what you're saying about his lack of sort of telegenics is also, the Republicans have this much larger, more ridiculous field of potential candidates, but so much we knew who all those people were before, not all of them, but you know, 5 or 6 of the very many of them were
at least 10 of them.
Yeah, before they, you know, before the debates, right? But these other guys on the stage with Hillary and Bernie, you're like, wait, who are you? And he's very impressive. He's got this long list of things. But if you haven't been paying attention, you're not going to know who he is, because he hasn't been out there like Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or any of these guys yelling about God knows what for the past 4 years.
Yeah.
And no, he's
not good at his own PR.
I think he actually does stuff.
Right.
Yeah,
he's
exactly.
A guy who gets stuff done. Yeah.
But I mean, back to Kate's point. You know, I mean, you could also make the argument that you have to understand what your job is in every situation, particularly if you're running for president.
Sure.
Your job here is to get ready to be on television, mm-hmm. and to figure out how this – like one of the things you don't do on Jeopardy is yell at Alex, right? Mm-hmm. We all know that. You know, no matter how things are going for you on Jeopardy, you don't yell at Alex Trebek, mm-hmm. all right?
Unless you're Sean Connery.
That's right.
Yeah.
You can yell at Will Ferrell pretending to be Alex Trebek, but nobody yells at Alex Trebek. And it's kind of the same thing. It's like – you know, maybe you don't like the rules or whatever, but you just don't spend your whole debate yelling at Anderson Cooper about you're not being
right.
I mean,
right.
And so you really have to understand that cameras are on you. Mm-hmm. So as bad as I feel for this guy, because I feel like everything about him is shortchanged in the ways that we're saying, you know?
You will see either a drastic change from coaching in the next debate, or he'll be gone. Right. I mean, because this is the reality that he has to deal with. And he seems to have demonstrated a track record of dealing with reality. You'd think he'd be an ideal candidate because he's a moderate Democrat. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like a species that's almost as rare as a moderate Republican or a moderate.
With better military credentials than any Republican he'll ever have to run against.
And a head like a thumb.
I did get some hope this morning, though, because I was wondering, you know, where are people like the Castro brothers
yeah.
from Texas.
Too young.
However, it's been announced today that Hillary Clinton is hinting at possibly naming Julian Castro as her VP running mate. Now, that would be exciting.
That's a sitcom because they could both prank her all the time.
That is true.
That's made for television right there.
That's good, Jim.
I thought, wait a second, didn't I?
Well, also, if we can have a president whose middle name is Hussein, we can have a vice president whose last name is Castro, right?
Right.
But that's sort of been dangled for a while there. It's a great move for her to make. And you know, I mean, they're not that much younger than some of the really young Republicans. They're not that much younger than Rubio. But so there is a little bit of hope.
How old exactly are they?
Oh, I wish you hadn't asked me that.
41.
41, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Rubio is, what, 42?
Yeah, so not that much younger.
Yeah. Well played.
Just barely younger.
All right.
We're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to switch gears. We're going to talk about tipping. We won't have a lot of time for this, so if you have a call you want to make, make that call.
We got a lot of contenders, so please keep it brief.
We need someone that understands the world today. In this country, we need brain.
Obama's finally trying to make a deal with Iran. Is it good?
All right. Welcome to Kate Rushen and Teresa Kramer and Jim Chapdelaine. They are the news today. This is a topic that never goes away. As I said, both John Nankoski and I have done shows about this. But some restaurants in the U.S. are starting to ban tipping and raise overall menu pricing to compensate. And now it's Danny Myers, a Universal Hospitality Group, announcing its decision to end tipping in all of its restaurants this week. It's an effort partly to balance wage inequality in the industry because chefs and kitchen workers often bring in less because their pay isn't subsidized with tips. Meanwhile, the wait staff is dependent on kind of a commission that's negotiable on the part of the commission payer, right? That's essentially what it is. They have sub-minimum wage in many cases, and then they're dependent on this process over which they have a minimal amount of control. So the idea is pay them a real wage, get rid of the tipping system. But, of course, a lot of consumers like the tipping system because it allows them to administer justice, you know, that you can reward somebody who's good. I guess you can punish somebody who's bad. We won't have a lot of time for this conversation, but we have some. And you should tweet at us at WNPRColin on this at WNPRColin if you have a strong opinion. Call in at 860-275-7266. We might squeeze a phone call on the air. We'll start with you, Teresa Kramer. Where are you on this?
Yeah, I have a hard time figuring out exactly how this will work just in terms of the different kinds of restaurants. So if you're like a diner waitress, mm-hmm. You know, you might have a problem with that because you're probably going to get paid minimum wage, which is probably less than you're actually making in reality But if you're working at a fine steakhouse where you're making like hundreds of dollars on any bill tipping anyway, it might work out for you because I mean, the math of – there's a lot of math involved, and I get confused.
Well, it's interesting because I had the exact opposite reaction. Yeah. So, but either we're both mm-hmm. right or one of us is wrong or something. My reaction was, for example, I know somebody, mm-hmm. Another Kate, who put herself through college and law school by working as a waitress at, you know, at the Max restaurants, right, which are kind of high ends, because there the numbers are big enough mm-hmm. so that if you're really good at what you do and you're a good waitress and you work hard, mm-hmm. you know, you can get enough money to put yourself through law school, which you can't do at the diner, right? Your tips mm-hmm. are never going to be big enough because all of the numbers are too small. So mm-hmm. I was sort of thinking, well, then maybe the person who's really going to get screwed or squeezed or something like that is that person who could have made a lot of money on tips being really good at it. But
I had also had that thought, okay. And I don't know which
so
one is right.
Basically,
either.
We don't know what we're talking about. Kate, help us understand this.
Yeah, well, I've worked as a chambermaid for tips and a dune buggy driver, and I've waited on tables in my 20s on Cape Cod. So I think because of that, I tend to overtip. Mm-hmm. And I also think I overtip because of stereotype threat, because there's this notion out there that black women don't tip well, mm-hmm. and God forbid that I should undertip. And I would also say save me from the group tip, because I hate going out with a bunch of people and then being the one to feel guilty and have to make up the difference for not enough tip. Mm. So I say eliminate tipping and pay the workers what they deserve.
It does make a certain amount of sense. And Jim, I want to get your opinion about this, but I also want to say that since Jim and I, our birthdays are pretty much synchronous. Of course, another thing that would go away is calculating the tip, which I always feel it's a nice neurological check for people who
are
our age.
I would say so. Yeah, I did it last night. Yeah. You know, I was a waiter. It's my only real job after high school was a waiter and back at the beloved Black Dog Taverns. I know. I waited on dinosaurs. And, you know, you can make a lot of money with tips if you're a nice person. And occasionally you'll get stiffed, not very often. But I wonder if the incentive goes away. And I wonder if our habitual inclination to tip people, I mean, how do you get rid of a lifetime habit of like, well,
it's really hard when you go to Europe or somewhere where they don't tip and you're like, well,
and they look at you like you're an idiot
yeah.
for giving them extra money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they have health care. Mm-hmm.
Tipping can be a little awkward, too, because sometimes if the owner is there, especially if the owner is older than me, like, do I tip? Do I not tip? Is this demeaning? You know, I find it very awkward.
And then there's all those other professions where who aren't affected by the wait staff and by the restaurant industry that you are supposed to tip, or maybe you're not supposed to. Do I tip the guy who just pulled my bag out of the car? I could have done that. I didn't ask you to.
I can tell you, I never tip my surgeons.
No.
I've just gotten a habit of not doing it.
So how you tip is often, or how you think about tipping, is sort of a byproduct of how you view mankind or humankind, right?
Yeah.
Because, well, really, because if tipping stops, if it goes away, then people will have no incentive to be any good at anything, you know.
So when did tipping start then? Did cave people like throw each other a bone?
Well, you know, there was an article in the New York Times today talking about, it was an op-ed, talking about some of the roots of tipping actually being linked to slavery and people.
Jeez. Yeah, and to Reconstruction, right? Because the notion was that people were uncomfortable paying black people a wage. So that tipping became sort of something for the black service sector, that it would be sort of voluntary to pay black people as opposed to compulsory to pay in order to maintain some of the vestiges of slavery. That's the argument made in the op-ed.
Why it remains just the service industry, basically?
Well, yeah, and I think that is part of it. But you know, it also goes to perception. So why don't you tip in Europe? Well, in Europe, France is the country that I know the best. So in France, you know, I mean, this is considered a profession, right? You know, people feel as though they've trained for it. It's something that they're
actually insulted sometimes if you tip.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. Same in Amsterdam.
Right. Because the understanding is, I mean, and there's a lot that goes along with that, too. I mean, because of who they think they are, not unreasonably, I shouldn't have put it that way, but because of their understanding of what their job is and
but
that it's a profession.
They're equal to you.
Yeah, that they are equal to you. That, I mean, one of the things that Americans routinely do not understand in France is that you really do address the waiter as monsieur. Mm-hmm. You know, he expects a certain amount of respect from you.
Right.
He considers himself to be a professional as opposed to a servant. Mm-hmm. And so the more you treat him like a professional, and the less you – we often treat waitstaff like – kind of like servants. Mm-hmm. Maybe like servants we like.
Yeah.
And that's why maybe the friendly waiter always gets a bigger tip, you know, that they have to ingratiate themselves to you. Besides the food, they have to bring a smile and a joke. And maybe speaking to your point, you know, they're the house person, you know, coming to bring you the – maybe it's vestigial.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's so great for a lot of women to have to put up with a boorish customer because she's worried about her tip.
But the other part of that is, I mean, so rarely in life do we have that kind of – ability to mete out justice, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I like – okay, I had to make a tip last night. I went out to dinner. It was my birthday. My son and I went out for sushi. And the waitress, in fact, was, I think, newly arrived in America, mm-hmm. Not completely conversant with the language. And so she really struggled, but she really worked hard at it too. Like, taking down our order, she was writing a little short story. Like, anything that got said – if I said I think she wrote right. You know, but just because that was important. Maybe is something. Right. Who knows? Right. You know, and so – I mean, I thought, well, you know, it didn't all work out exactly right, and certain things didn't come exactly the – but, you know, I mean, I gave her 20% because that's like – it seems right, you know? I mean, she's trying to make it in America.
And it's your birthday.
It's my birthday. So and I think we do that all the time. But, you know, like if somebody fixes your car really well, they get paid the same amount mm-hmm. as if they screw it up and
– Maybe we should just start tipping everybody.
Well, I don't know.
And I have to say this, a doctor who takes your appendix out mm-hmm. because he's supposed to – and takes it out because he isn't supposed to, gets the same amount.
Right.
I mean, there might mm-hmm. be repercussions.
I do always tip it. I tip it my physical because it just seems, you know, I mean.
Yeah, yeah. You know.
But particularly then if you're David Letterman's doctor,
as your
then we can.
If they don't find anything, I feel like here's $20. Yeah. Thanks.
But then if you're David Letterman's surgeon, you can become a celebrity.
That's
all
right.
They're telling us we have to go. Some very nice people are now going to ask you to support this show. It's so important that you do that. Support the show and the station.
And then they say, come on now, where's your smile?
Thank you for listening to this show. Colin McEnroe produced it with some help from Betsy Kaplan, and I produced it too. I hope you enjoyed, you know, the show, which I produced. Okay, bye now. I'd also like to thank Professor Dumbledore for providing me with this apparently invisible tip jar. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our intern is Amanda Gallagher. The part of Bill Curry was played by Lincoln Chafee. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff fighting over the tip pool, visit our website WNPR.org/Colin. On Monday's show, The Scramble visits with Bob Woodward. And now... back to Colin.
Yeah, we'll do other stuff on Monday, but I've already recorded an interview with Bob Woodward. Bob Woodward, of all people, of course, thought that he knew everything there was to know about Watergate. And then it turned out Alexander Butterfield, who's the guy who revealed the existence of the fabulous taping system, who's now 88, he's now 89, but when he was 88, told Bob Woodward, no, actually there's some stuff you don't know. And that's what our conversation is going to be about.
Did you mean that literally or in general or specific to this topic?
Yes. Well, actually about Watergate, yeah. I mean, there may be there's a lot of other things. I mean, Bob Woodward doesn't know how to turn on a laptop. I mean, there's a lot of things he doesn't know, but this is about Watergate. All right, so here we go. For our final segment here, let me reintroduce Teresa Kramer from The Cut, poet Kate Russian from katerussianpoet.com, and Jim Chapdelaine, guitar hero, producer, cancer activist, many other things. They're the nose here today. So for our final topic, for a while we were talking about and reading this essay that ran in the New York Times Sunday Magazine last weekend by Wesley Morris. He's got the greatest job in the world, Pulitzer Prize winning critic. Wesley Morris is the new kind of critic at large, try to synthesize all of culture, critic for the New York Times. And he wrote this piece called Why the Year We Obsessed Over Identity. And the subhead was 2015's headlines and cultural events have confronted us with malleability of racial, gender, and sexual and reputational lines. Who do we think we are? Well, that was kind of a hard thing to – I mean, he says some really interesting stuff. I'll read one paragraph. He's talking about Rachel Dolezal, who's kind of the poster girl for this. If you remember, she's was the head of a Texas division of the NAACP. Was it San Antonio? I think it might have been. And she said she turned out – she said she was black. She turned out not to be. She represented so – he says there was something oddly compelling about Rachel Dolezal too. She represented dementedly but also earnestly a longing to transcend our historical past and racialized present. This is a country founded on independence and yet comfortable with racial domination, a country that has forever been trying to legislate the lines between whiteness and non-whiteness, between borrowing and genocidal theft. We've wanted to think that we're better than a history we can't seem to stop repeating. Great paragraph, like so many of Wesley's lapidary paragraphs. But once again, hard to get around without having a specific example. And then tragically, one has appeared, and that is Lamar Odom, an incredibly talented basketball player back in the day, rose up from – I think he played for Rhode Island in the college level, played for a series of pro teams and shone while playing for the Lakers. And then something else happened. At an August 2009 party thrown by his teammate or for his teammate, Ron Artest, he met Khloe Kardashian. And the rest, unfortunately, is TV history. Keeping Up with the Kardashians began to include him. There was a spinoff called Khloe and Lamar in January of 2011. And then other things started to happen. His basketball career took a turn for the worst. Things didn't work out all that well with Khloe either. And now he's been found in a legal Las Vegas, Nevada brothel and is in the hospital and is very, very, very sick. And one senses he may not make it. There's a obviously the implication being that drugs are somehow or other involved in all this. So I don't know. In some ways, he kind of is, to me, a story about trying to transcend something that maybe he ultimately didn't transcend. But, Kate, I'm going to start with you. You wrote in one of the many emails exchanged before the show today, branding like social media, Hollywood, reality TV, etc., can overtake and consume our frail human selves. Tell us more about what you mean by that.
Well, you know, Lamar Odin had talent, money, fame, and I guess he and Khloe, I guess, felt like they'd hit the jackpot when they met each other and got married 1 month later. And all of that wasn't enough to help him deal and overcome whatever demons he was dealing with. I guess it's really a tragedy. And I think an added irony is that the owner of the brothel where he was found, Dennis Hoff, actually had his own HBO reality show called Cat House. And so it just compounds the tragedy, I think. We have this reality show within reality show within reality show, and at the heart of it, we've got this very talented young man in an induced coma fighting for his life.
So, actually, you said tragedy. Jim Chapdelaine, also in our emails, I think you said there was something Shakespearean about the whole story. Say what you mean.
Well, he's such an epic figure now. I mean, it's such a tragic way for him to go out because he had transcended a family that was rife with drug abuse and addiction, and by virtue of his talent somehow managed to elevate himself into a pretty good place. And he was always a really likable, affable teammate, I thought. I really liked him, as compared with the Meta World Peace or Ron Artest, who was always kind of like cranky. And I think this idea of it dovetailing with the cat house thing that Kate brought up is even more weird than anything. But for him to go out like this does seem like an epic tragedy. And it doesn't look like he's going to come back.
So this, Teresa, this man, Lamar Odom, was a product of public housing and who dealt with very tough circumstances growing up. His father was largely absent. His mother died of cancer when he was 12. He then lived with his grandmother, in a pretty tough part of Queens, I think. And then I think maybe one of the lessons here, maybe an obvious lesson, is if you want to transcend your origins, if you want to escape who in fact maybe society intended you to be, which is a victim and someone living at the lower strata of society, a basketball career is a great thing. Maybe reality television is not a good place to go to transcend who you are, although for a while you might. I don't know. You did get a chance to see a little bit of this as it played out before you cut the cord, apparently. You got a chance to see a little bit. I don't know. Do you have any theories about what reality television either did or didn't accomplish for Lamar Odom?
I think it would be too simple to blame reality television. I get the impression that he already had a problem that was sort of being hidden on the show to some degree. Khloe knew that he had a drug problem and that he was cheating. And there was one article about how sort of sensitively he was actually treated on Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And a lot of that was intentionally hidden from the cameras, it seems like. And it wasn't until his spirals, got to the point where Khloe left him and it was in the tabloids that it sort of became a problem. And I mean, there are plenty of people with very similar stories to Lamar Odom in the NBA and, all across professional sports, I would imagine, who do not have this particular problem. And it's, and I wonder if the American people can will sort of get a lesson from this, that drug abuse is much more serious, that it, you know, it's not a failing of your character, it's a disease. And I wonder if people will sort of get that from this story.
I mean, Kate, it seems to me that this is maybe I'm forcing these two things into collision, the Lamar Odom story and this Wesley Morris essay. But his whole essay is about that question. I mean, the American myth is, to a certain degree, that our circumstances are malleable and fungible, that, you know, we don't have to stay at the station into which we are born, that almost anything is transcendable. And then the modern myth is that things are even more transcendable than they ever have been before. We have a president who's both black and white. We have a reality TV. We have Olympic athletes, male Olympic athletes who become women and become, you know, idolized in some quarters for that, that that all kinds of things can change. And that seems to rub up against this sense that at another level, nothing changes, that things are really, really hard to change. And you look at Lamar Odom and it's hard not to think that, wow, I mean, he kind of had everything, but in some ways – it feels to me, maybe I'm imputing too much, like his past, his origins are dragging him down. There was something, some early wound that he couldn't escape.
Now, the word that comes to my mind is isolation, that somehow, you know, in the middle of the NBA, he's an NBA star, he's a reality TV star, and still somehow he's essentially isolated. And I guess the question for me is, how does someone like him or any of us deal with that isolation?
Mm-hmm. And from an early age, from his history, it sounds like that's the thing that he had as a companion was no companion.
All right. I'm being reminded right now that because of fundraising, we've only got about 4.5 minutes or so left, 4 minutes left to do our endorsing. So let's do our endorsing. We have to say goodbye to Lamar Odom. I hope not permanently. But Teresa Kramer, who or what would you like to endorse?
There's a documentary that I believe you can still watch on Netflix and I think is being re-released because it's called You've Been Trumped. And it's all about Donald Trump terrorizing these poor farmers in Scotland so that he can try and build a golf course and basically ruin the Scottish coastline. And it is, if you want to see who Donald Trump is, watch You've Been Trumped.
All right. Kate Rushen, what would you like to endorse?
Well, the Hartford Public Library is launching its One Book Hartford campaign. And this year it's a novel by James Baldwin, If Beale Street Could Talk. And folks can get information from the Hartford Public Library online, hplct.org.
All right. And Jim Chapdelaine?
During our multiple emails, I went back and referenced one of my favorite books, The Moral Animal by Robert K. Wright. It didn't provide me with any guidance, but I realized, boy, I could get lost in this book very quickly. And probably people should dig into their wallets and send you guys a couple of bucks.
All right.
We'll endorse you guys.
He endorses pledging to us. So Kate helps me remember that on Tuesday, and you still have time, really. This is not a slow read. It's a pretty fast read. Purity by Jonathan Franzen is going to be our sort of book club discussion. We're going to do a one book thing. She's shaking her head. Oh, you're shaking your head. Yes or no? She's shaking her fist.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not good. Purity by Jonathan Franzen. We're going to talk about that on Tuesday. We've got a panel of Alex Dubin and Julia Pastel and Rand Cooper. We'd love for you to read Purity. You could knock it off over the weekend, really, because you'll enjoy the show so much more. That'll be on Tuesday, so please do that.
Teresa.
I want to endorse the podcast that I just appeared on, Unorthodox. It's hosted by an occasional NOS panelist, Mark Oppenheimer, and it's about Jewish life, Jewish affairs, Jewish news. I was the what they call the Gentile of the Week on the show, I prefer it, token goy or Goykin. But it's actually a great podcast, and they've sort of mastered what I think to be the heart of podcasting, which is to have a stable cast of, you know, they've got three people who the interplay of their personalities is really what makes the podcast. So so just check this out. Even if you're not Jewish, check it out. Unorthodox. It's run by Tablet, but I think it's part of that sort of panoply network of podcasts. What else was I going to say? Oh, I do want to endorse that Wesley Kathleen Morris essay, if you didn't catch it in the New York Times last week, please do. If nothing else, for a description of the most recent Nancy Meyer movie. She's the one who she directs.
That
like
was so good.
Yeah, he refers to the new one as another of Nancy Meyer's bourgeois pornographies.
For and that, there's even an Eddie Van Halen reference
right.
in there.
For that phrase alone, read Wesley Morris. Wesley Morris was great anyway. And since I actually have a few seconds left, you guys were so succinct. I will, if you ever get a chance to see this, this is so on the nose to what we've just been talking about, the play Red Velvet, which is the story of the black American actor, Ira Aldridge, who in the 1830s began performing classic Shakespearean roles to European audiences. And who were shocked. They were shocked to see a black Othello. They were used to Edmund Kean playing him as a sort of bronzed Arab or to centuries of white actors playing in blackface. So I've seen it performed by Adrian Lester, one of the great actors in the world. It's also been done by John Douglas Thompson. If it ever gets staged again, I don't know who's left to do it. Those two guys are about as good as it gets. But Red Velvet is an amazing play.
Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington.
I thought Anderson Cooper did a good job. I'm giving him a 5% tip, Bernie.
Hillary, why are you one percenters such low percenters when it comes to tipping?
Well, let's see how much Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee are tipping, Anderson. Hey, guys. Guys? Aw, they stiffed him.